series on the book of Ecclesiastes. Technically Lent begins on Wednesday at the Ash Wednesday service, which is at, does anybody know what time it is? Six. Thank you. Yes, at 6 o'clock Wednesday evening. Love to have you come out for that. And that is technically the beginning of Lent, and I wanted to study through this season Ecclesiastes. If you want to flip there, it's going to be after Psalms and Proverbs, and before Song of Solomon, and we'll be reading just chapter 1 today a little bit, I think. But lately, this has been one of my favorite books. And in this book, I'm going to try to help us kind of wrap our heads around it a little bit. In this book, we will meet essentially two different characters. There's the author, the writer of the story, sort of shows up and says, hey, let me tell you what this guy says. And then there's this guy. Now, this guy, who he wants us to hear from for most of the book, in the ESV, he's called the preacher. I think the NIV says teacher. He goes by different names. But the two of them kind of come together, and they're trying to teach us something. So now, first question, who are these people? We're not 100% sure. For a long time, it was thought that the preacher was Solomon. That's possible. There's some reasons in the text to maybe think that. The history of the book is a little bit murky. Nobody's sure exactly who wrote it or who is this that we're talking about. So there's that. And then, in addition, I suppose the tone of this book is maybe not as uplifting as the modern evangelical devotional reader may want. There have been seasons throughout the book where Christians have thought, I don't know that that belongs in the Bible. The Bible's supposed to be uplifting. To them, I would say, hey, read it again. Another sermon. We'll talk about that. But there have been times when people debated, should this be here? And by God's goodness and providence, it is. And we get to read it and try to discern, really, what is it that is trying to be communicated to us about the human condition? So we're going to have to do a little work to get through this, but I promise you that we will experience some of what the author is hoping that we will experience as we study it. So if you would read with me, I'm just going to read through chapter 1. It's not terribly long, so we can get a sense, and we'll talk a little bit about it. Verse 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanity, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams go, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and know madness and folly. I perceived that this also was but a striving after the wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Let me pray for us. God, would you be with us? Open our ears and our hearts and our souls to your word. Help us hear what it is you intend us to hear from this book. It's in your name, Jesus. Amen. All right, so again, who is the preacher? You could see as I read there, there's a couple of references to King in Jerusalem. I was king of Solomon is historically the greatest, sort of wealthiest, wisest, most powerful king in Jerusalem, although he was only officially the third king. So when he says, surpassing all who are over Jerusalem before me, it really, that doesn't seem like a tremendous accomplishment. So maybe he is Solomon talking. Maybe he is a fictitious character the author made up in order to make a point. We don't know for sure. The word that's used here for the name, the preacher, is Koheleth, which in Hebrew, it means literally assembler, the one who gathers, right? Technically, this morning, Jim would have been our assembler when he brought us all together for a call to worship. It might be, that's why it's translated preacher, right? The one who gathers the people to hear him speak. Possibly, maybe he's the one who's gathered all these life experiences that he's going to tell us about, or all these anecdotes, or this data. Maybe he's the gatherer of data. We're not really sure. What we do know is he does not dodge the difficult questions. The preacher is not in search for easy answers, cliches, things that'll just, you know, silver linings. That's not, that is definitely not the preacher. And so I think to start, it's a good, let's ask this. What is it? You could think of this book almost like an extended sermon. So you ask, beginning, you're supposed to say, you know, what is it I'm going to tell you, right? What does the preacher want us to hear in his sermon? What is it he wants us to hear? I think, first of all, he wants us to hear him say that everything under the sun is meaningless. He's going to say that quite a few times. Everything is meaningless. But I don't think he wants to stop there. Why? Why is it meaningless? Because the gain that we seek doesn't exist under the sun. That's what he's trying to drive at. So when he talks about under the sun, another way I like to, a phrase I like kind of better than under the sun personally, is east of Eden. We know the story. We know, you know, Adam and Eve ate the fruit, made choices to go their own way instead of God's, and God sent them east of Eden. We're told, it's interesting, we talked last several weeks about the creation account. God made man to multiply and subdue the earth, right? To make babies and build things. When they go out east of Eden, think about it. You will have pain when you make babies, and you will have thorns when you try to grow things. The very thing that you were created to do will now become frustrated, so that in all of our toil under the sun, in all of our work east of Eden, there is it's frustrating. And then what happens in the midst of the frustration? Look at what he says. Our times and our lives fade. 1:4, a generation goes, a generation comes, the earth remains forever. Psalm 90 also captures the same sentiment. The years of our life are 70, or by reason of strength, 80, yet their span is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone, and we fly away. Again, he's not in search of silver linings. This, we don't like this, but to kind of help make his point, I want to show you a few pictures. Can we see some of those pictures? Who knows who that is? Tanya Harding, that's right, Tanya Harding. Okay, she was, actually, some of you might know her because the movie just came out, the movie based on her life just came out. In the early 90s, I just found this out from Troy the other day, I think, she was the second most famous person in the world behind Bill Clinton, who was, for some of you, a president at the time. So if you ask 6 billion people in the world who were alive at the time who they knew, the second most popular, Tanya Harding. Some of you may not know her now. Let's see, who's next? Who knows who that is? John Lennon, that's right. I'm betting some of you don't know who that is. Tessa, you know who that is? No. Sorry to call you out. We love you. He was, for some of you that may not know, he was one of the Beatles. I just heard it was just however many years the other day since they first landed in America. You know, I mean, people went nuts. Now there's people in the room don't know him. All right, let's see who's next. Who knows this one? Getting fewer? Clark Gable. The actor, Clark Gable, that's right. He was Rhett Butler. He, for some of you, for you younger folks who might know Brad Pitt is, this guy put him to shame with his wealth of work and some would say acting skills. I'm not going to get into that debate. He was huge for a few decades there in the early to mid-1900s. How about this one? Who knows who that is? Lindbergh, that's right, Charles Lindbergh. Good job, Don, excellent. Yeah, that's Charles Lindbergh. Bert flew the first plane across the Atlantic Ocean solo. Probably the most famous person in his era, right? Everybody knew him. A lot of things happened in his story that are fascinating. Now, for some of you, this will be interesting. For some of you who might have known all those names and are like, yeah, these young folks, they'll know anybody. Let's see who knows who this is. Drake! This guy is the singer of the current Billboard number one hit. And some of you who knew all the others might not know him. All right. How about this? Anybody know who that is? I'm wondering if anybody knows his name. His name is Edgard Varese. Anything? Yeah? I was wondering if Brad might know his name. He's known as the father of electronic music. He was, early 1900s, the guy who sort of first said, you know what, we can make music with electronics. And now we do it every week. And now one person in the room knows his name. And then we have this guy. You may know that one. I'm wondering if anybody will recognize this name. His name is John Smeaton. Anything? He is the first person to ever take science and art to build buildings. He coined the phrase civil engineer and founded the very first Society of Engineers in London. We can thank this guy for the Golden Gate, the Brooklyn, the London Bridge, the Memorial Bridge. He's responsible for creating the first guy to do something other than chop down a tree and lay it over a river. Civil engineering. He started it. This is the author's point, the preacher's point in Ecclesiastes. The day after we die, the sun will go up in the morning. You go down and you stand at the river. You can go stand by the banks of the Missouri River and you watch the water flow past. And for centuries, people whose names we will never hear have stood on the banks of the Missouri River and watched the water flow by. And 100 years from now, people will stand at the banks of the Missouri River who have never heard our name and never will. And the water will flow by. This is a painful tension. Nobody wants to think, oh, we'll be forgotten soon. We don't like that. That makes us, there's not language. It makes us ache. It makes us groan a little bit. It hurts. And so he goes on to say that because this hurts, because this creates this tension, we look for satisfaction in other things. We look for satisfaction in wisdom. He says, I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this is also but a striving after the wind. Chapter 2, verse 1, he'll say, I said in my heart, come, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself, but behold, this also was vanity. He goes on to talk about accomplishments and status and possessions and wealth, and he'll say, all of these things are vanity. It's his favorite word, vanity. Some translations, I believe the NIV says meaningless. This is hard because translation is always a tricky thing, and I don't really think any translation really captures this well, because when we say meaningless or vanity, we automatically conjure up certain ideas in our head. The Hebrew word is hevel, which literally means smoke, vapor, wind. It's not a negative connotation. He's not saying, oh, don't pursue wisdom, it's awful stuff. That's not his point. He's saying it's like smoke. It's like trying to grab a hold of mist. And that's what it means. Two things, really, that he's trying to say about all of these things that are hevel, meaningless, vanity. Number one, they're fleeting. They're fleeting. They're here today, gone tomorrow. You might have a great time on Saturday night. I promise you Sunday morning's going to hurt. It's fleeting. It comes and goes. And it's hard to grasp, right? Build a fire in my backyard, try to grab a hold of the smoke. You can't do it. You can't. And I think by that, he means two things. It's impossible to hold on to, right? You can't get it in your hand, these things, so that you keep them necessarily. And also, it's really hard to understand. It doesn't make sense why, and he'll get to this later. Like, we think, and Proverbs teaches, another book by Solomon, and even in times, the Ecclesiastes will teach almost contradictory messages where he'll say, oh no, if you have wisdom, then you can at least have a good life. And then it'll come back and say, yeah, but you know what? The wise and the rich, the wise die young and the fools live forever. It doesn't make any sense. I know wealthy people who are just awful, and I know poor people who are good, and it just doesn't make any sense. Vanity, that's what he's trying to say. I don't understand why it is the way that it is. It makes no sense. That's part of what he means. You can't hold on to it, and you can't explain it. It's interesting. Ecclesiastes is originally written in Hebrew, later was translated to Greek, and the Greek version of the Old Testament is what many of the New Testament writers would have read. Paul, granted he spoke Hebrew, but he would have had a Greek copy of the Old Testament, and in his version of Ecclesiastes, this word hevel, this word that we say is smoke, in the Greek version of Ecclesiastes, it's a different Greek word, metatoies. Now, here's what's fascinating. Paul, who wrote the book of Romans, would have read Ecclesiastes in Greek. Now, follow me here, because he uses the exact same word for smoke in our New Testament. In Romans chapter 8, this is what it says, for the creation was subjected to, okay, futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. It was subjected to... I always think of... You guys seen Glory, the movie? You seen this? Great movie. Denzel Washington was in it. Matthew Broderick. Came out early 90s, probably. Loved it. It was about an African-American unit in the Civil War. In it, there's this character who I always think of. I mean, this is kind of unrelated, but I always think of this character who he kind of had a stutter, and he kind of talked like that. Wonderful character, great development, beautiful story. But they called him Can't Get Right. That's what they called him, Can't Get Right. All the time they were talking. And I hear his name in my head so often when I'm thinking about this kind of stuff, because I just can't get right. That's the way I feel. Sometimes nothing works the way it's supposed to. The expectations that I have, you ever feel that? There's a tension here. There's a tension. In fact, I think the author wants to create this tension for us. I think he wants us to feel it. And he's not going to release us from it throughout the book. He's building and building and building. It's like the punchline. You know, somebody tells a joke and then they leave the room right before the punchline. You're like, seriously? We want the release of the tension especially those of us who are comfortable and maybe more accustomed to the victorious sort of Western Christianity where you pray a prayer and then you live like it's kingdom come, right? I think the writer, the preacher, definitely the preacher, would be horrified that people who carry this book around with his book in the middle of it, right? That people who carry his book around would use the words victorious Christian living in the same sentence. I think he'd be horrified. Because he would say, what do you mean? It's all vanity. Now, I mean, look what he does. Verse 13. It is an unhappy business that God has given the children of men to be busy with. See, we want him to say, okay, I know, but, and he doesn't. He lets us feel that, to sit in that. He builds it up. He says this thing that, frankly, if most of us read that on the street, or, you know, we'd think it was heresy. It is an unhappy business that God has given the children of men to be busy with. Breathing is hard. You know, if the preacher were a painter instead of a preacher, I think the picture he would paint would be a frowning God standing by the flaming sword just east of Eden, pointing, sending Adam and Eve off to live in futility, to live where they just couldn't do what they were made to do. We don't like that. God sent us out to live in a land, and it is an unhappy business. And we want escape. We want release from that. This may be why suicide is the 9th leading cause of death in the U.S. We want out of a way of living under the sun, of living east of Eden, this unhappy business. For others of us, we look for escape or to release the tension. That's what we really want. Let me loose from that tension. I don't like it. And so we look, you know, in these other places, the victorious Christian life. Hurrah! We got it all now, baby. Maybe wisdom, because we take a little comfort. I take a little comfort in knowing more than other people. Look at me. Right? Vanity. That one in both senses of the word, maybe. Pleasure. If I just feel good for now, I can sort of open up the valve and release some of the tension. Status. If other people are looking at me thinking, oh, how great they are, right? Then we can breathe a little easier. All these things, he says, is vanity. They're all meaningless because that comfort, that release, that tension, that valve that we so desperately long for, it doesn't exist under the sun. East of Eden, we cannot fully and truly experience that. That's why I wanted to look at this book during this season of Lent. In Lent, the church is called to remember that we are ashes. We are dust, and to dust we shall return. Our lives are short. That life east of Eden will never fully satisfy our longings. That we were made with these good and deep and rich and beautiful desires that will never be fulfilled until all things are made new again. There is going to be a tension. If we don't feel the tension of that, then we're not living in the real world. During Lent, we're called to let go of the hope that anything but Jesus will set us free from the anxiety and the tension that we have, living in a world that's not the world we were made to live in. And Jesus himself said, in this world you will have trouble. And he knows. He knew very well. He walked the same earth. He lived himself east of Eden under the sun. He knows what it feels like to have unmet longings, unrequited passions, desires that just and this feeling that it can't, it's not, it won't be what I want it to be. He dealt with that on his last night when his soul was burning within him and he was in anxiety and fear and he didn't want to face what he had to face, and he so much stress that he literally sweat blood, and he wanted one thing. He wanted his three closest friends to stay up with him and pray, and they fell asleep. He knows what it feels like to live east of Eden because he did it. But remember, the next breath, he said, in this world you will have troubles. And in the next breath, he said, but take heart, I have overcome the world. We don't overcome it. We can't. We won't. But he did. That is our hope. That's the hope that Paul had. When he said, remember, everything in creation was subjected to hevel, to futility, in hope that the creation itself would be set free from the bondage to corruption, free to become children of God. That is our hope. That is what we live for. That is not where we live now. We still live in a broken world. We live in a world that can't get right. We live east of Eden. But we have a king, a hero, a rescuer who has overcome the world. Let me pray for us. Jesus, thank you. Thank you that you have overcome the world. You have conquered sin and grave. You who promised to make all things new. Jesus, we cry out, will you carry us in the tension of living in a world we're not made for, and strengthen in us the hope that you are coming soon to make all things new. And Jesus, will you come quickly? Amen.